Hello everyone, so I have to tell you the female misogynists that were within the crime world. You have the misogynistic Puritans, even though they're small in number. So the organized crime world has the misogynistic Puritans. The misogynistic Puritan takes the ideal woman to be domestic, subservient, nurturing, kind, mild-tempered, alluring, youthful, and sexually pure prior to marriage. She has adopted this feminine ideal from her misogynistic husband, family, or acquaintances. She takes herself to be pretty damn close to the feminine ideal. She is subservient, always standing behind her man as a solid pillar of support. She hates women who deviate from the feminine ideal and takes it to be her life's mission to find ways to discipline them and ultimately get them on the right track. In the organized crime world, you have the misogynistic self-critics. They are innumerable, actually, in the crime world. The misogynistic self-critic is disdainful toward women who are not very feminine, whether it's because they choose not to be or because they are just bad at acting in a traditional way. For instance, women she takes to be too fat, too big, too masculine, too angry, too loud, too competitive, too hardcore, or too alpha. She is in favor of traditional gender roles and will use any opportunity she gets to preach their social virtue. Men should be dominant alphas, women should be soft and compliant. She may regard herself as one of the feminine misfits. In the crime world, there are the misogynistic self-loathers. They are the most common kind of women in the crime world that I was exposed to against my will. The misogynistic self-loather has adopted a general attitude of contempt toward every one of her own quote-unquote filthy kind, including herself. She regards women, including herself, as promiscuous, manipulative, dishonest, irrational, incompetent, or unintelligent. She tends to be in denial about her own self-loathing, but not usually about her contempt for other women. In the crime world, there are the misogynistic she-devils. They are the second most common type of women in the organized crime world that I saw. The misogynistic she-devil sees herself as superior to other women and at least on a level with, if not above, the top alpha male she encounters. In her view, other women are manipulative, dishonest, irrational, incompetent, or unintelligent, but somehow she is exempted. She might possess some stereotypical feminine virtues like beauty and slenderness, but she perceives herself as instantiating the stereotypical masculine virtues of intelligence. The strength of character and rationality in her behavior is more manly than that of her male co-workers, classmates, or friends. In this case, her crime buddies. Don't be surprised if she can out-drink and out-smoke and out-party all of them. That was what I saw in real life. She is in constant competition with other women and would rather kick a woman off the career ladder or out of school than help her progress. But she masterfully escapes detection and punishment for her bad behavior. As you wait for the elevator with your box of memorabilia and your withering office plant, your rival is one step further up the career ladder, her triumphant laughter hanging in the air. And don't be surprised if she can out-sex all of them, out-rob all of them, out-kill all of them, and out-beat up other people all of them. I also saw that in the crime world too. She is host to dark personality traits. Her firm belief that she is superior to other women points most strongly to narcissism. But narcissistic traits are also routinely present in borderline personalities and psychopaths. In the general population, dark traits tend to be subclinical, which means that they are not associated with the level of dysfunction seen in clinical cases. But mixing high functionality with sinister character traits is more likely to give you a Molotov cocktail than a cosmopolitan. I would say that the Puritans were the least common amount of women in the crime world. And I noticed that I was able to talk to female misogynists, and I was able to change a lot of their thinking. Over time, me noticing how they treat women, and I would politely ask them about it, and they said they grew up in homes where women were hating other women. And so I helped them to understand that you could love another woman peacefully without having to one-up her to feel good about your own womanhood. So their hearts got softened over time, and their female misogyny ended over time, because nobody ever talked to them about loving your own womanhood and loving the womanhood of other women. So that's what I saw growing up. There was also the good girl syndrome, and the nice girl syndrome. So for example, they had this false belief that other people's feelings and needs were more important than their own. They had this false belief that if I'm nice or fair to other people, they will all be nice and fair to me. They had this false belief that what other people think of me is more important than almost anything else, including my self-esteem, my health, even my safety. And there were these good girls believed, in quotations, good girls, this false belief, I need to be good and perfect to be accepted by all and loved by all. I also noticed that they felt a lot of pressure to be what everybody wanted them to be, and they couldn't be what they wanted to be. They suffered from perfectionism, people pleasing, putting other people first all the time, issues with their body image, and yes, they had sexual difficulties and they had a history of trauma. And it's a double standard, right? So boys and men can get away with anything. Girls and women can get away with nothing. Be hard on the females. Be easy on the males. Be yelling and screaming and cursing and making fun of and being harsh toward the females, but don't do anything toward the males. So there are double standards all the time. You know, like, I remember, those are the dangers of cis heteropatriarchy. They feel like these are the ways that I have to overcome misandry, is to be a part of misandry. And if I have to overcome misogyny, I have to embody it. For example, they would blame themselves when something went wrong. They would doubt themselves, couldn't doubt their perceptions, their knowledge, and their beliefs. They would be overly trusting of others even when someone has proven to be untrustworthy. They were naive when it comes to the motives of others. They believe they should attempt to meet the needs of others no matter what the consequences or hardships to themselves. They were raised in misogynistic families. The women were very passive in the family. They had abusive, tyrannical males in the family. And they had parents who placed too high value of being fair, compassionate, and nice, always to the detriment of girls and women. There was experiential beliefs that the females formed as a result of their personal experiences, including their childhood traumas. They had familiar beliefs passed on to the females by her family, either directly or by witnessing parental other family members' misogynistic behavior. The cultural misogynistic beliefs passed on to the females by the culture society in which they were raised, and they felt like there was a biological predisposition to misogyny going on in the family. And so the nice girl, the women that had the nice girl syndrome and organized crime, everything I'm about to read to you describes them 100%, and it sucks that I have to even say these things. So the first statement applies to some of the women in organized crime. Nice girls are compliant. They do what they're told. They've learned that it is easier to do what someone asks than to risk an argument. Some women in the crime world, this description fits them. Nice girls are passive. They're often afraid to stand up for themselves, causing them to be easily manipulated and controlled. They are afraid to speak their mind, either out of the fear of hurting someone else's feelings or out of fear of being rejected or hurt themselves. Nice girls can be wishy-washy because they're so afraid of confrontation. They say one thing one time, another thing another time. They want to please everyone all the time. Because of this, they agree with one person and turn around and agree with someone else who has the exact opposite belief. Last statement on nice girls and organized crime. Nice girls can be phony. They're afraid of telling others how they really feel. They pretend a lot. They pretend they like someone when they don't. They pretend they want to be somewhere when they don't. So you pretty much get the point of how they had nice girl syndrome because of the sexual assaults and domestic abuse and the verbal abuse. So what did I say to the nice girls? I used to tell them how God felt about them and how I told them every way they were raised was wrong and hurtful to God. And I even quoted scriptures that talk about Jesus' concern for women in the book of Luke. And that's what healed them of the nice girl syndrome. They let the nice girl syndrome go completely. They let the good girl syndrome go completely. They let the squeaky cleanliness go completely. And so they started being their real selves. They stopped being pushovers and doormats. They started sticking up for themselves, speaking up for themselves, standing up for themselves, sticking up for each other, speaking up for each other, standing up for each other. Because I told them, hey, the book of Luke, Jesus cares for you, cares about you. He has concern and compassion in his heart that he expresses to you. That's what helped them out. So the crime world has what is called the Messiah complex. I saw a lot of criminals having the Messiah complex. The Messiah complex is a mental state in which a person believes they are a Messiah or prophet and will save or redeem people in a religious endeavor. The term can also refer to a state of mind in which an individual believes they are responsible for saving or assisting others. In the crime world, I saw people with the Cassandra syndrome. The Cassandra metaphor variously labeled the Cassandra syndrome complex phenomenon, predicament, dilemma, curse, relates to a person whose valid warnings or concerns are displeased by others. The term originates in Greek mythology. Cassandra was a daughter of Priam, the king of Troy. Struck by her beauty, Apollo provided her with the gift of prophecy, either on the condition that she agreed to accept his romantic advances or without prior agreement from Cassandra, depending on the source. But when Cassandra refused Apollo's romantic advances, he placed a curse on her, ensuring that nobody would believe her warnings. Cassandra was left with the knowledge of future events, but could neither alter these events nor convince others of the validity of her perceptions. In the crime world, I witnessed the savior complex. In psychology, a savior complex is an attitude and demeanor in which a person believes they're responsible for assisting other people. A person with a savior complex will often experience empathic episodes and commit to impulsive decisions such as volunteering, donating, or advocating for a cause. A person with a complex will usually make an attempt to assist or continue to assist even if they are not helpful or are detrimental to the situation, others, or themselves. In the crime world, I witnessed the Superman complex. In psychology, a Superman complex is an unhealthy sense of responsibility or the belief that everyone else lacks the capacity to successfully perform one or more tasks. Such a person may feel a constant need to save others, and the process takes on more work on their own. The expression seems to have been first used by German-American psychiatrist Frederick Wortham in his 1954 book, Seduction of the Innocent, and his testimony before the Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency. Wow. There were, in the crime world, I saw many of the criminals having the superiority complex. A superiority complex is a defense mechanism that develops over time to help a person cope with feelings of inferiority. The term was coined by Alfred Adler, 1870 to 1937, the early 1900s, as part of his school of individual psychology. Individuals with a superiority complex typically come across as supercilious, haughty, and disdainful toward others. They may treat others in an imperious, overbearing, and even aggressive manner. In everyday usage, this term is often used to refer to an overly high opinion of yourself. So in the crime world, I witnessed an inferiority complex. In psychology, inferiority complex is a constant feeling of inadequacy, often resulting in the belief that one is in some way deficient or inferior to others. According to Alfred Adler, feeling of inferiority may be brought about by upbringing as a child, for example, being consistently compared unfavorably to a sibling. Physical and mental limitations or experiences of lower social status, for example, being treated unfavorably by one's peers. An inferiority complex may cause an individual to overcompensate in a number of ways. For example, a person who feels inferior because they are shorter than average, also known as the Napoleon complex, we'll get to that next, due to common modern-day heightism, may become overly concerned with how they appear to others. They may wear special shoes to make themselves appear taller, surround themselves with individuals who are even shorter than they are. This is taken to the extreme and becomes a neurosis. It may also cause an individual to be prone to flashy outward displays with behavior ranging from attention-seeking to excessive competitiveness and aggression in an attempt to compensate for their either real or imagined deficiencies. In the crime world, I witnessed the Napoleon complex. The Napoleon complex, also known as Napoleon syndrome or short man syndrome, is a purported condition normally attributed to people of short stature with overly aggressive or domineering social behavior. It implies that such behavior is to compensate for the subject's physical or social shortcomings. Both commonly and in psychology, the Napoleon complex is regarded as a derogatory social stereotype. The Napoleon complex is named after Napoleon Bonaparte, the first emperor of the French, who was estimated to have been 5 feet 2 inches tall in pre-metric system French measures, which equals around 1.67 meters, or just under 5 feet 6 inches in the imperial measure. He was of average height among all men in France, but was much shorter than the elite soldiers, aristocrats, and high officials that he met with. In the crime world, I witnessed toxic positivity. Toxic positivity or positive toxicity is dysfunctional emotional management without the full acknowledgement of negative emotions, particularly anger and sadness. I always say this, emotions are not negative, it's about what you do with them. Toxic positivity is a pressure to stay upbeat no matter how dire one's circumstance is, which may prevent emotional coping by feeling otherwise natural emotions. Toxic positivity happens when people believe that negative thoughts about anything should be avoided, even in response to events which normally would evoke sadness, such as loss or hardships. Positivity is encouraged as a means to cope, but tends to overlook and dismiss true expression. The concept of unrealistic optimism was explored by psychologists at least since 1980, and the term toxic positivity first appeared in J. Halberstam's 2011, The Queer Art of Failure, which to poke holes in the toxic positivity contemporary life. In the crime world, I witnessed the God complex. A God complex is an unshakable belief characterized by consistently inflated feelings of personal ability, privilege, or infallibility. The person is also highly dogmatic in their views, meaning the person speaks of their personal opinions as though they were unquestionably correct. Someone with a God complex may exhibit no regard for the conventions and demands of society, may request special considerations or privileges. I saw people in the crime world having the Jehovah complex, which is a related term used in Jungian analysis to describe a neurosis of egotistical self-inflation. In the crime world, I witnessed egotheism. Egotheism or autotheism is the deification or worship of the self. Critics of Johann Gottlieb Fichte and Ralph Waldo Emerson used the terms to label their transcendental philosophy. Autolatry is another synonym which is used to label the ideology of Max Stirner. In the crime world, I witnessed the cult of personality. A cult of personality, or cult of leader, is the result of an effort which is made to create an idealized, heroic image of a glorious leader, often through unquestioning, flattering praise. Historically, it has developed through techniques of mass media, propaganda, spectacle, the arts, patriotism, and government, organized demonstrations, and rallies. A cult of personality is similar to apotheosis, except that it's established by modern social engineering techniques, usually by the state or the party, one-party states and dominant party states. Cults of personalities often accompany the leaders of totalitarian authoritarian governments. They can also be seen as some monarchies, theocracies, failed democracies, and even in liberal democracies. In the crime world, I saw people playing God. Playing God refers to assuming powers of decision, intervention, or control metaphorically reserved to God. Acts described as playing God may include, for example, deciding who should live or die in a situation where not everyone can be saved. The use and development of biotechnology such as synthetic biology and in vitro fertilization. Usually the expression is used pejoratively to criticize or argue against the supposedly God-like actions. Playing God is a broad concept which is encompassed by both theological and scientific topics. When the term is used, it can be used to refer to people who try to exercise great authority and power. It is usually pejorative and suggests arrogance and misappropriation of power or tampering with matters in which humans should not meddle. In the crime world, I witnessed fanaticism. Fanaticism from the Latin adverb fanatis, friend, fanaticus, enthusiastic, ecstatic, raging, fanatical, furious, is a belief or behavior involving uncritical zeal or an obsessive enthusiasm. Philosopher George Santayana describes fanaticism as redoubling your effort when you have forgotten your aim. The fanatic displays very strict standards and little tolerance for contrary ideas or opinions. Tuno Lettstar has defined the term fanaticism as the pursuit or defense of something in an extreme and passionate way that goes beyond normality. Religious fanaticism is defined by blind faith, the persecution of dissidents, and the absence of reality. In the crime world, I witness Grandiose delusions, GDs, also known as delusions of grandeur, expansive delusions, are a subtype of delusions characterized by extraordinary belief that one is famous, omnipotent, wealthy, and otherwise very powerful. Grandiose delusions often have a religious, science, fictional, or supernatural theme. Examples include the extraordinary belief that one is a deity or celebrity, or that one possesses extraordinary talents, accomplishments, or superpowers. In the crime world, I witnessed the Atlas personality. The Atlas personality, named after the story of the Titan Atlas from Greek mythology, who was forced to hold up the sky, is someone obliged to take on adult responsibilities prematurely. They are, as a result, liable to develop a pattern of compulsive caregiving in later life. The Atlas personality is typically found in a position who felt obliged during childhood to take on responsibilities such as providing psychological support to parents, often in a chaotic family situation. An assault in adult life can be a personality devoid of fun and feeling the weight of the world on their shoulders. Depression and anxiety, as well as oversensitivity to others and an inability to assert their own needs, are further identifiable characteristics. In addition, there may also be an underlying rage against the parents for not having provided love and for exploiting the child for their own needs. While ATLAS personalities may appear to function adequately as adults, they may be pervaded with a sense of emptiness and be lacking in vitality. In the crime world, I witnessed hero syndrome. Hero syndrome, also referred to as a savior complex, hero complex, is a psychological disorder that causes a person to seek recognition for heroism. Though hero syndrome is not recognized by the American Academy of Psychiatry due to its inconsistency with the definition of a syndrome, its definition is encapsulated under the hero complex. Hero syndrome is by definition a complex as individuals who present this often exhibit impulses that have a common emotional tone and exert a strong but usually unconscious influence on the individual's attitudes and behavior. However, in popular media and literature, it is referred to as the hero syndrome. The term is used to describe individuals who constantly seek appraisal for valiant or philanthropic acts, especially by creating a harmful situation which they then can resolve. This can include unlawful acts such as arson. This term has been used to describe the behavior of public servants such as firefighters, nurses, police officers, security guards, and politicians. The behaviors of individuals with hero syndrome can be detrimental to the lives of those around them, putting innocent people at risk in the pursuit of creating a victim. Reasons for this kind of behavior often vary. So these were the things I saw growing up in childhood. And the last thing I remember about that crime world is the self-deprecation. Self-deprecation is the act of reprimanding oneself by belittling, undervaluing, disparaging oneself, or being excessively modest. It could be used as a way to make complaints, express modesty, invoke optimal reactions, or add humor. It may also be used as a way for individuals to appear more likable, agreeable, as a form of self-defense, a warped sense of politeness, and a traumatic comedy. So when I remember being in that world was, sometimes I was stalking dudes. I would go find them because they were abusive towards the ladies. And I did a lot of breaking and entering at the time because women would tell me where they lived. I would wait for them on the porch, mean mug them, and sometimes beat them before they got into their homes. I would use their restrooms, and I would eat their food and watch their TV on the couch without their permission. You've heard these stories. Let me give you new details about it. I would go around asking the neighborhood about them. Their whereabouts I was asking for, and they would tell me, oh, he's 4 blocks away, he's 1 block away, or he's 6 blocks away. How did I get there? On foot, or hitchhiked, or drove. When I first started driving, I would sit on women's laps and they would have me drive the car a little bit, you know, hands on the wheel. They kind of put my feet on the brakes and everything, and to keep driving. And I remember driving cars that were tailor-made to my size, they're able to find manufacturers that would give me small cars, and I would drive. How to learn how to drive? Well, when you're around criminals, they'll be willing to teach you anything. They were like, yeah, it'd be cool if you could drive, you know. But most of the time, I would get rides from women at the time in the crime world, so I didn't drive all that much. Plus, they didn't want me to, so That's why that didn't happen. And with these guys, I remember, you know, finding them, breathing down their neck, hovering over them. They're sitting down. And I was so angry that I whispered death threats, violent threats. And I did that because in my mind, my grandma taught me that women had to be respected. And if you weren't living up to my grandma's standards of respecting women, I didn't feel like you were worthy of living. At the time, I was 5, so I grew up in a hyper-violent, hyper-murderous world. I wasn't trying to be a killer. I wasn't trying to be fearsome. I wasn't trying to even be violent. But when you're in that world, it's hard not to adopt some of the atrocious characteristics, atrocious attributes even. And this is me being at 5. This is what happened. And I was just trying to protect women, and I didn't know how to do it. And, you know, last time I'll talk about that world is basically this. In terms of the pimping, right? I need to talk a little bit more about that. When I was a pimp, against my will, I was the kind of pimp that didn't want them to have a whole lot of clients. I didn't trust the women with a lot of dudes, male pig, misogynist. So we made the most money with the fewest amount of adult male clients for the street workers, so to speak. Brothel workers, so to speak. But the interesting thing is, with some of the women, they had a strong belief in God, some of the brothel workers. So I was the kind of pimp that we would preach Christian sermons to each other. We would do, we would dance to Christian music together. We would, say Christian prayers to God with each other. We would do Christian dance with each other. We would do, Christian meditation with each other. We would do, we would do Christian commemoration and veneration of the Holy Trinity together. And we would quote, recite, and speak biblical scriptures to one another at that time. So the best way I can explain was a lot. Sometimes I brought up my views on religion. There were some criminals who would talk religion. So when they would talk religion, I would speak to them Christian morals, Christian beliefs, Christian worldviews, the Christian text, Bible, Christian sanctified places, Christian prophecies, Christian ethics, Christian organizations, designated Christian behaviors, designated Christian practices, the Christian religion, the divine from the Christian perspective, sacredness from the Christian perspective, faith from the Christian perspective, supernatural beings and supernatural being from both from Christian perspectives. We have Christian sacred histories, Christian narratives, Christian symbols, Christian holy places, the explanation of the origin of life from the Christian perspective, the universe from the Christian perspective, the phenomena from the Christian perspective, you know, discuss Christian sacrifices, Christian festivals, Christian feasts, Christian trances, Christian initiations, the Christian perspective of matrimony and funerary services, Christian public service, the concept of saints from a Christian perspective, Christian rituals. That's how it was. Only if they asked, because some of the criminals grew up in religious households, whether it was Islam, Judaism, Christianity, in some cases Buddhism, Hinduism. They had a little bit of everybody in each religious walk of life in those worlds. We would talk about awareness of Christian individual death, a sense of Christian community, Christian dreams, because most of the criminals had Christians in their families. I did too, so that was my way of overall dealing with that world. That's the best way to put a bow on that world, like a nice bow tie to end me talking about that particular part of my life forever. Now, let's end the sexual past talk of my life forever, shall we? You know, back then, and I can be honest here, within my sexual past, I must admit that we had reckless sex in the women's alcoves, atriums, attics, basement, cellars, bathrooms, bedrooms, nurseries, box rooms, storage room, conservatory, dining rooms, family rooms, dens, fireplaces, foyers, front rooms, garages, hallways, pastures, vestibules, hearths, home, offices, studies, kitchens, larders, laundry rooms, libraries, living rooms, lofts, nooks, pantries, parlors, porches, recreation rooms, rumpus rooms, television rooms, shrines to serve religious functions, associated with family, stairwells, sunrooms, swimming pools, windows, and workshops. And we did those things because when you're traumatized, you're not always mindful of whereabouts, feelings, and I think subconsciously when you're traumatized, you may show signs of the Jonah complex, which is a psychological condition that sabotages people's dreams of greatness and regulates them to live in mediocrity and conformity. It is named after the biblical character Jonah, who attempted to flee the fate God had decreed upon him. The Jonah complex is the fear of success, or the fear of being one's best. This fear prevents self-actualization or the realization of one's own potential. Maslow used the Jonah story from the Old Testament to illustrate this there. So we were showing signs of the Jonah complex to each other without even knowing it. And, you know, when I look back on it, they had the sister complex because they were traumatized. The sister complex is a state of strong attachment and obsession to sisters. It's commonly abbreviated as SISKON, S-I-S-K-O-N. This term refers to a psychological phenomenon where an individual has an intense and sometimes obsessive attachment to their sister. It can manifest as excessive love, possessiveness, or even jealousy towards the sibling. That happened because sometimes the sisters were always compared to each other by other relatives and neighbors in the community. And plus they were traumatized together, so they had a codependency of each other. Now, looking back on it, we may have shown some signs of the Peter Pan syndrome unintentionally. The Peter Pan syndrome is a pop psychology term used to describe an adult who is socially immature. It refers to never-growing adults who have reached an adult age but cannot face their adult sensations and responsibilities. It is a metaphor based on the concept of not growing up being trapped in childhood. So, to some extent, we had that. And it's not easy for me to admit these things. It is not. But this is how you heal, by saying, hey, at the time, we had to be adults all the time, so we were children when we weren't supposed to be as adults, but we have an inner child. It's not that simple. So, I remember that there was a history of Stockholm Syndrome in their families, and I can say to some extent it happened to some people I was related to. There are four key components that characterize Stockholm Syndrome. A hostage's development of positive feelings towards the captor. No previous relationship between hostage and captor. A refusal by hostages to cooperate with police and other government authorities. A hostage's belief in the humanity of the captor, ceasing to perceive them as a threat when the victim holds the same values as the aggressor. In other words, Stockholm Syndrome is a proposed condition or theory that tries to explain why hostages sometimes develop a psychological bond with their captors. It is supposed to result from a rather specific set of circumstances, namely the power imbalances contained in hostage-taking, kidnapping, and abusive relationships. Therefore, it is difficult to find a large number of people experience Stockholm Syndrome to conduct studies with any sort of validity or useful sample size. So, this explains a lot of why we sexually did what we sexually did. I think another one is we had the Wendy syndrome. We had the Wendy syndrome. Wendy syndrome is a popular psychology term used to describe an adult who is empathetic, nurturing, even self-sacrificing. It is named after Wendy Darling, a fictional character who is Peter Pan's friend. It is not an official diagnosis, but a concept coined by psychologist Dan Kiley in 1984. People with Wendy syndrome act in a maternal way with their loved ones, satisfying their needs and forgetting about themselves. They may have a fear of abandonment and rejection. And so I think we also suffered from betrayal trauma. Betrayal trauma and betrayal blindness is it manifested in within our families. There was infidelity trauma. For example, in our families, there's a history of trouble recognizing, expressing, managing emotions, anxiety, depression, other mental health symptoms, nightmares, physical pain, or stomach distress, panic attacks, thoughts of suicide, difficulty trusting others, attachment issues, eating disorder, substance use, and the infidelity trauma, loss of self-esteem and self-worth, numbness, anger, guilt, difficulty controlling emotions, intrusive thoughts about affair details, loss of faith in others, suspicion, hypervigilance, depression, anxiety, other mental health symptoms, physical symptoms including insomnia, pain, and stomach distress. Yeah, that's, well, insecure bonds and insecure attachments. That's what we had. The lingering trauma. Yeah. Betrayal trauma is a specific trauma that happens in key social relationships where the betrayed person needs to maintain a relationship with the betrayer for support or protection. It can affect your self-esteem, emotional health, and relationship with others. So that's what we were suffering from, too. And I noticed that they had what is called the Cinderella complex. Some of them. The Cinderella complex was first described by Collette Dalling, who wrote a book on women's fear of independence and unconscious desire to be taken care of by someone else. The complex is said to become more apparent as a person grows older. The complex is named after the fairy tale character of Cinderella. Its title refers to an ideal of femininity as portrayed in that story, where a woman is expected to be beautiful, polite, supportive of others, but fundamentally incapable of either taking care of herself or changing her situation through her own efforts. Instead, she is taught that she needs to be protected and taken care of by usually another, usually a man, example, the prince. Dowling examines the deleterious effects of the socializational psychology of girls and women. That's what happened to us. And so that's pretty much everything that occurred in our lives. And so the sexual past part of my past has been officially told. I left nothing unsaid when it comes to that, so I say no more on that. And the organized crime part of my life, I left nothing unsaid when it comes to that, so I say nothing more on those things. I left no tables unturned. I left no tables unturned. All the tables have been turned on those subjects. And so I finally get to rest when it comes to these subjects. I'm so grateful. All my childhood traumas have been officially communicated. I left nothing unsaid and no tables unturned on those things, the childhood traumas either. So I get to let go and let Antonio.